Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Frank Perez, whose new book is Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis, Essays on Queer New Orleans History. Frank Perez is one of the foremost scholars of gay life and history in New Orleans. He's co-founder and current executive director of the LGBT Archives Project of Louisiana, an instructor in the Office of Professional and Continuing Studies at Loyola, owner of Crescent City Tour Booking Agency, and a columnist for Ambush Magazine and French Quarter Journal. As if that weren't enough, he's the author of Treasures of the Vieux Carré, 10 Self-Guided Walking Tours of the French Quarter, and Political Animal, The Life and Times of Stuart Butler. What a wonderful book that is. Co-editor of Southern Decadence in New Orleans, My Gay New Orleans, 28 Personal Reminiscences on LGBT Plus Life in New Orleans, and In Exile, The History and Lore Surrounding New Orleans Gay Culture and Its Oldest Gay Bar. But today we're talking about a new book, Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis, Essays on Queer New Orleans History. Frank, welcome.
Hello, Susan. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you back. But I mean, what a lot of work went into this book. 85 essays.
Yes, and those aren't all of them. Those are just the 85 I picked. But these come from a column I've been writing for almost 15 years. And so it was just a matter of culling through all those that I had previously published and picking the ones that I wanted to include.
How'd you get the idea for the essays? I mean, are they things that people who've taken your walking tours of the quarter have asked you about or things like that?
The motivation primarily came from the previous books I've written. And when I've written about either the life of Stuart Butler or the history of Southern Decadence or the bar, there were things I wanted to include that need to be included, but I had to keep reminding myself I'm not writing a comprehensive history of queer New Orleans, right? And so that book still needs to be written. And I figured I've written enough essays that I could maybe put together something that would be a first step in that direction. I think this current collection of 85 essays is a good primer for anybody who wants to do further research.
Mm-hmm. So how did you begin life as a columnist? That's a pretty nice story, I think.
Well, it started in a bar.
See, of course.
In 2011, I think, is when my first book, In Exile, was published. In the course of researching that book, I had interviewed Rip and Marcia Nakan-Delane, longtime fixtures in the French Quarter, who lived in the 800 block. They also owned and published Ambush Magazine, which was a magazine, still is a magazine, aimed at the LGBT community, not just in New Orleans, but along the Gulf Coast. Been around since 1982. And so when the book came out, In Exile, I guess it must have been around 2012, I ran into Rip and Marcia at Lafitte's In Exile, and they were impressed with the book, and they asked me if I would be interested in writing a column on queer history for Ambush. And I just jumped at the chance. I'm still writing that column all these years later. And a lot of the essays in this book come from that.
Isn't that funny how your life can turn on a dime like that? In a bar.
In a bar. Well, yeah. I mean, it was quite happenstance, but very fortuitous. And I'm very grateful because Rip and Marcia became very, very close friends. I talk about them a little bit in the introduction to the book. They really had a profound impact on the course of my, not only life, but professional career here in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. So you've been an English professor, you studied English, been a grad student. So being a columnist is something a little different. You have to have a voice and a sense of self that you're establishing trust with the reader over. So tell us how you went about developing that voice, or if it was natural to you.
Was it natural? I'm going to say Ness and you. Because initially when I started writing the column in 2012, I had in mind the audience. Who reads Ambush? It's primarily a bar rag. It had a wider readership readership, but it was mostly distributed to a gay male audience in bars. And so I didn't want the column to be too heavy academically. I wanted it to be accessible yet entertaining. Just considering my audience is what shaped the voice, that changed a little bit, slightly nuanced, when I started writing for French Quarter Journal, which launched in 2019, which is an amazing online resource. And that readership, that circulation is a little bit different than Ambush. And so I always have my readership in mind when I'm writing.
Yeah.
But to further complicate finding one's voice, my true audience is a graduate student 100 years from now.
Aha.
So when I'm writing columns for Ambush or French Quarter Journal or whatever it may be in these books that I write, I'm always thinking, I want to be able to help a graduate student or a researcher 100 years from now who's researching whatever. Because when I started researching local queer history, there was nothing. Nothing but arrest records and newspaper accounts of raids at lesbian and gay bars.
Right.
So
now there's a lot, thanks to you.
Well, I don't know if my first couple of books angered enough people that they wrote their own or maybe inspired others to write their own. But I'm glad that other people are doing queer history now. Mm-hmm. And we've been very, very fortunate for that.
And we were just talking to an archivist who here at the UNO Library, and you are one of the founders of the LGBTQ archives. So you know what paper matters.
Yes.
You know, I mean, and why we should collect all these documents and keep them in one place. So talk a little bit about that work and why it's been so important.
Sure. Well, the LGBT Plus Archives Project of Louisiana is a federally recognized 501c3 statewide organization that grew out of the research I did for these columns. When my first book, In Exile, was published, and then I started writing the column for Ambush, Stuart Butler, who was a longtime elder and activist in the queer community, invited me over to his home, along with several other people that he knew were interested in queer history. And he showed us this vast array of banker's boxes that were filled with papers. And we're like, Stuart, what is all that? And he began showing us. It was all the paperwork ever associated with his career and life as an activist. I'm talking about agendas at board meetings, membership rosters, posters for protest rallies, you name it. And he was like, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I'm going to die soon. And what's going to happen to all this? And he challenged us to begin thinking about what we could do to preserve queer history. And so we began meeting once a month at his home, the very famous, iconic Red Creole Cottage on Esplanade Avenue, which is known as the Ferry Playhouse. And we maybe a dozen of us, give or take, each month. And we began just brainstorming. We didn't want to create our own museum or archival repository because we all had day jobs. But we began to explore and investigate and go to all the repositories in town, from the public library to all the university libraries to the Historic New Orleans collection, you name it. And we basically asked the question, do you have LGBT material? And if not, do you want LGBT material?
Mm-hmm.
And the universal response was, yes, we want LGBT material. We need more. We have a little. We want more. And so we decided instead of reinventing the wheel, we would just create this statewide collective that reaches out to the community and says, hey, if you got a box or whatever, let's get it somewhere where it can be properly preserved.
Yeah, that's a very creative way to do it.
And it's a unique model that has worked really well for us over the last dozen years or so. We've facilitated the donation of major collections to archival repositories and museums all across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, we also do public programming. So each year we have a programming focus. It's usually a gap in the historical record of queer history. And then we also, because we know where everything is, are able to provide consulting services for people who are doing queer research, whether that's a graduate student or a podcaster or a filmmaker, you name it.
Well, why not a museum now that you mention it?
Well, if anybody in the listening audience wants to donate $10 million, we'll be happy to open a museum.
I guess. Okay. It's always money, isn't
it? Yes,
it
really is.
It's always money.
We did have a small exhibit space in the French Quarter just before COVID.
Mm-hmm.
It was very small, but we had a few exhibits. We had a timeline of queer history and some photographs and whatnots. And we didn't market it. We didn't really advertise it. People just walked in and were so impressed with what we were doing, they would leave donations.
Nice.
And that paid for the rent. But during COVID, the landlord would not work with us, and without walk-in traffic, we couldn't afford it. So we would love to get a new exhibit space. We need a space. ideally in the quarter or close to it. But most of what we do in terms of locating these collections and getting them properly preserved in archival repositories is something we can do behind the scenes.
Yeah, but still, somebody had to start. And yes. I remember when you told me about that meeting, it gave me goosebumps just to think of what could have been lost if you hadn't risen to the challenge.
Well, and I think, Susan, you were friends with Alan Robinson.
Of course.
Yes, and Alan, when he passed away, his family had come to clear out his house, and they put boxes of his papers out on the sidewalk that was going to be thrown away. And a member of the local community, Mark Gonzalez, happened to be walking down the sidewalk, down the street, and saw it and asked, can I take this? It's important. And they're like, we don't care.
Oh, wow.
So he preserved the Alan Robinson papers, which are now at Tulane. And Mark was very instrumental in getting the archives project off the ground as well.
Tell our listeners a little bit about Alan Robinson, about who he was.
Alan Robinson was this amazing man who had been an activist as a graduate student before he came to New Orleans in 1975. He got involved with and co-founded something called the Gertrude Stein Society, which was sort of a queer social club with a political underbelly.
Yeah.
He eventually owned the bookstore that had been opened on Frenchman Street by Tom Horner. He was a co-founder of LAGPAC, which was the Louisiana Lesbian and Gay Political Action Caucus. And he was just very much involved.
Human rights campaign,
the whole nine yards. So he was just this amazing man who had a really profound impact on local queer history.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Frank Perez, whose new book is Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis. One of the things that you get a sense of reading this book is what gay history looked like as it happened here. One of the unique things, of course, that we have is Gay Carnival. And writing about that must have just been fun, fun, fun.
It was. You know, when I do my Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis walking tour, I try to point out to my guests that despite what they think, the queer history of New Orleans is not unlike that of other cities. You know, we're very inclusive now.
Mm-hmm.
We're very gay-friendly now, but it wasn't always that way. And so I say, that being said, there are a few things that make our history distinctive and unique, and Gay Carnival is certainly one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I open the book with a chapter on Gay Carnival. So the book is categorized into 17 different categories or topics, and then there are 5 short essays related to each topic. And then there's an introductory essay that ties them all together.
Yeah.
And Gay Carnival is the first.
It's very easy to use.
Yes.
And you don't have to read it in any particular order.
No, you can jump around. Because these columns originally appeared in periodicals, they're fairly short. You know, they range from 800 words to maybe 2,000 words each.
Mm-hmm.
So easy to digest.
It's one of those books you want to have on the coffee table when guests come from out of town. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, some of the things that you have borne witness to are happy things like Gay Carnival, but some of them not so much. There's the upstairs lounge fire, HIV/AIDS, the good and the bad. So talk about apportioning that, if you will.
Sure. Dividing all the essays I've written, which are number in the hundreds, was very difficult, but I wanted to pick categories that painted a full picture.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole section on HIV and the AIDS crisis. The Upstairs Lounge Fire is a seminal moment in our city's queer history. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, last year somebody stole the plaque, the memorial
Absolutely.
Plaque.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We are rededicating that plaque on Sunday, the 22nd at 5 p.m. We've ordered a new one. It's being installed this weekend. We're going to unveil it and have a little ceremony with the second line
on
Sunday evening,
that's
the 22nd at 5 o'clock.
Because it took so much work to get it in the first place.
Yes. I mean, it took a long time. That original plaque was placed in the sidewalk in 2003 for the 30th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And for your listeners who may not be aware, somebody pried it up and stole it last year.
Sold
it to a junkyard or a metal yard to melt it down for the bronze.
Incredible.
He's in jail now, so that's good.
Yeah, yep. And you also point out some of the gay artists who bring glory to New Orleans.
Oh, yes.
So talk about that.
Well, I think writing, because I'm an old literature professor, I think it was not only easy but really fun for me to write about queer writers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole section on artists like George Durow, Francis Benjamin Johnston, Tennessee Williams, and also John Kennedy Toole.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you were friends with Kenneth Holdridge. Mm-hmm. Right. So a couple of years ago, before he passed, Kenneth Holdridge and I were part of a panel discussion on Thelma Toole's 100th birthday, anniversary of her birthday.
Yeah.
And during that panel discussion, I asked him if I shared with him that I always suspected John Kennedy Toole was gay. And I asked him if he had any insight or evidence about that. And I talk about this in the essay in the book. He mm-hmm. said that he did, and that he and I should get together for lunch, and he would show me what he had. And we tried three or four times, missed attempts, and then he got sick and died before yeah. we could actually meet. So his papers are currently in the process of being archived. And when they are, I'm going to go through them and try to find that piece of paper that he was talking about. But he did confirm to me that John Kennedy Toole was indeed gay, which I think is significant because it's an illustration of what I try to do in the book and with my tours and my work with the Archives Project is that, and that is simply to recover the contributions of queer people to the city that have gone unrecognized.
And to elevate them.
Yes.
Of course.
Which is important.
And of course, then there's Tennessee Williams.
Yes. I need to write a whole book about Tennessee
Sigh.
Williams.
Sigh. Yes. Tennessee Williams.
So the article I've included about Tennessee Williams is entitled Tennessee Williams Out in the Quarter, In on the Stage. And it's about his life as a gay man in the French Quarter, but also about how the homosexuality in his work is kind of subtext, but you have to read between the lines, but how that informs his work. So that was one of my favorite ones.
What were the most difficult essays for you to write?
The HIV AIDS.
Really?
Essays, yes, without a doubt. Even though I wasn't writing about my own personal experiences with people uh-huh. I lost, the topic was just so profoundly sad and disturbing that I found those very difficult to write.
Mm-hmm.
But important. They're important stories
very important.
To tell.
There's always something that gets you as a writer, you know, when you have to write every week.
Yes.
And there's something you have to write and you know it's going to be difficult.
That's why I try to give myself plenty of time. You know, every writer will tell you they have their own process and routine.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is I have to write every morning. Morning is the best time of the day for me to write. And so I try to wake up early every morning and spend a few hours before the phone starts ringing and the emails start coming and the text alerts go off. And some mornings I'm more fruitful than others, but no matter what, as long as I write something in the morning, I like to think of it as money in the bank. You can always withdraw it later and,
right.
and rework it or add to it later.
Now I'm curious, what are your favorite gay books?
Oh, that's such a that's like asking what my favorite restaurant is. Well, since he just passed, I would mention anything by Edmund White.
I know. I was quite sad about that, too.
Yeah, that was really sad news. I was friends with him, but became acquainted with Edmund White, along with Felice Picano, who died last year, or earlier this year.
I know. Heartbreaking.
And Andrew Holleran, who is still with us. And all three of them used to come every year for the Saints and Sinners. Literary
yes.
Festival. And so, but anything by those guys. I mean, Andrew Holleran's Dancer from the Dance was really impactful for me.
Mm-hmm.
And Vito Russo's Celluloid Closet also played a big role for me.
Mm-hmm. But Edmund White and Felice and Andrew Holleran were all part of that group that really made gay writing mainstream.
Yes, the Violet Quill.
The Violet Quill.
There were seven or eight of them. Many of them died of HIV way back when. And I think Andrew Holleran is the only one left.
And he is. Yeah. I cherish him. He yeah. is an amazing writer.
He is a very down-to-earth kind of guy, too. In fact, I submitted a story for the Saints and Sinners short fiction contest a few years ago. And it was the year that Andrew Holleran was the judge.
Uh-huh.
And the story I wrote was humorous. And he named it runner-up. It didn't win, but he mentioned it in the introduction to the anthology. And he wrote one of the best compliments I've ever received. He described it as a sort of gay confederacy of dunces.
Whoa.
Which just made my writing pride
take
soar.
That to the bank.
Yes.
I'm curious what the people who take your walking tours want to see. What kind of questions do they ask you? What's the craziest thing anybody's asked you?
The craziest question anybody on tour has ever asked me is, there's an anthropology professor
uh-huh.
And it was she was the only one. I'll do this tour for one person because I feel it's important, even though it's not really financially worth my time. But she wanted to know if I could speak to the role, the dreams of menopausal women in indigenous native diplomacy.
You are kidding me.
I am not kidding you. I've given thousands of tours. I've been asked millions of questions. That was a first. And I looked at her and I said, I don't think I can. but what I can do is talk to you about the role of women and gender roles in indigenous culture that were very shocking to the heteronormative patriarchal ideals that arrived with the Europeans and the colonizers. And she was happy with that.
Nice comeback.
Yes.
I'll give you an A for that.
Yeah, that's what I pulled out.
Well, what are the places they want to see? What do you take them
They
to?
Don't know. They don't know what they don't know. And So I offer my tour by appointment only for the most part. And so I customize it and tailor it to whatever their needs are. So the Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis tour that I give to two cisgender white gay men from Des Moines is going to be different than the tour I give to two 20-year-old trans women of color from New York.
Yeah.
So I just customize it depending on the audience. Mm-hmm. Who's on tour? I ask them, you know, what are you interested in? Do you want bar history? Do you want political activism? Do you want what? And usually they say a little bit of everything. But lately we get a lot of gay literature questions, a lot of gay literary heritage in the French Quarter. So that's always fun to talk about as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, where Tennessee Williams lived when he wrote Streetcar is just right around the corner from where Truman Capote lived when he wrote Other Voices, Other Rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And although he wasn't gay, William Faulkner was right there in the alley. He had a gay roommate named William Spratling.
Quite famous.
Yeah, so.
There's a lot there.
So what does the tour cover? I don't know. It depends on who's on tour.
What's the standout, you think?
One thing that sticks with people that surprises them, and I do have a chapter on this in the book, is about how 120 years ago or so, there was serious discussion of destroying the entire French Quarter. They were just going to demolish it.
Oh.
You know, the city council actually passed an ordinance, or a resolution, I should say, in, what, 1895 or 1896, authorizing the demolition of the Cabildo.
Mm.
And it was a gay man, a gay architect, who stepped up to the plate and led the effort to preserve it. And it was other gay men who really fought for the preservation of the French Quarter 100 years ago.
Wow.
And so if it weren't for queer men 100 and 120 years ago, you might not have a French Quarter today.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Frank Perez, whose new book is Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis. The nice thing about this book, it has that kind of ambling spirit. I mean, you've got it arranged to where it's easy to use. It's charming. It's just like, stop here, stop there. It's just enough. It's just right, you know?
Well, that's very kind. I mean, I try to make them, you know, when I write these essays, I try to make them enjoyable. Try to be humorous if it's appropriate. I also want to offer a lot of encyclopedic detail without being too heavy with it. So if people are interested, they can pick that up and do further research. One topic I wrote about many years ago was the Hammer murders in 1984. There was a serial killer killing gay men with a hammer. And I devoted, I think, a paragraph to that in my first book. Somebody read that book and is now doing a full feature-length film, a documentary on the Hammer murders because of that paragraph.
Oh,
so you
great.
Never know. You never know
Yeah.
what interest you're going to spark.
Have you given tours to lots of movie folks?
Oh, yes.
I bet.
Yeah. A lot of filmmakers as well, documentary filmmakers and other filmmakers as well. So, you know, because of my work with the Archives Project and plus all the work I do with these columns and books, I get contacted constantly by everybody about researching the most obscure topics. And it's a joy to talk with them. Yeah.
We're lucky to have work that we love so much.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking with Frank Perez, whose new book is Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis, Essays on Queer New Orleans History. You can meet him Sunday, June 22nd at Bywater Bakery at 10 a.m. And again, June 30th with Robert Fiesler and Larry Bagnaris at BK House and Gardens at 6. Thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library sponsor a warehouse sale Saturday, June 21st, from 9 a.m. to 1 or until sold out. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Books will be sold by the box, including CDs, children's books, fiction and nonfiction, cookbooks, romance, and regular fiction. Boxes are labeled as to category but cannot be opened prior to purchasing, so it's a great way to acquire wonderful mystery books at a bargain price. Payment may be cash or credit card. For more information, contact the Friends at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Blue Cypress Books presents a story time, Scrim on the Run, Sunday, June 22nd at 1. Frank Perez, whose new book is Rainbow Fleur-de-Lis, signs his book Sunday, June 22nd at Bywater Bakery at 10 a.m. and again June 30th at 6 at BK House and Gardens. Dr. Jonathan Higgins appears in conversation with Ryan Gilbert to discuss Black Fat Femme, revealing the power of visibly queer voices in media and learning to love yourself. Tuesday, June 24th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Celebrate the One Book, One New Orleans selection, Daughters of the New Year by E.M. Tran, with Pages and Plates, and afternoons of treats, crafts, and storytelling. Wednesday, June 25th from 5 to 6:30 at Algiers Regional Library. Kelly Carter Jackson discusses her book, We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance, Thursday, June 26th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.